It is Wednesday, June 26th. Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Cherry.
Yes. Avi.
The Inquirer reported this morning that there's going to be an upscale Taco Bell opening in Center City. Will you go with me and get a drink at the upscale Taco Bell in Center City?
Wait, what exactly this upscale?
I don't know. It's called Taco Bell Cantina. It's a new Taco Bell model.
Oh.
It's coming to Philadelphia.
And they have drinks.
They've got alcohol.
Look, I'm always
Chalupas
down for,
and alcohol.
Look, I never say no to a margarita.
All
so
right. You'll get a drink
go.
With me at Taco Bell Cantina? If you want to get a drink with us at Taco Bell Cantina, email studio2@whyy.org.
We'll probably get email
on the show today. On the show today, there is a Taco Bell, Deep South Philly. Near it, there is a ship, a big, big ship that's been docked for a long, long time, but it might get evicted. This historic ship is fighting for its life. We'll tell you more later this segment. Middle segment today, the Supreme Court of the United States. They're right in the middle of releasing all sorts of opinions. We'll talk to an expert about what's happened so far in the session and what might happen in the next few days. And then finally, at the end of the show, an interview by Cherry Gregg with an artist who's making big waves with a very big installation at the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
Yes, lots to talk about. And if you have any questions about the Supreme Court cases, any feelings about some of the ethical issues that have come up about the individual justices this session, call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email your thoughts to studio2@whyy.org. In Delaware, Avi, the Delaware Senate passed a medical aid in dying bill that would allow terminally ill adults the right to self-administer medication that would end their life. It is now on the desk of Governor Carney, awaiting his signature. Now, this bill was very controversial, and it would basically limit the bill's scope is basically limited to individuals who are diagnosed with terminal illness that have 6 months or less to live. Mm-hmm. And it's been very controversial in the state, had a lot of passionate debate. It took two attempts to get it to pass through the Senate, and it passed narrowly, 11-10.
That's as narrow as it comes.
With people opposing it, citing their religious beliefs for their stand against it. So it's unclear if it'll actually become law, but we'll see if the governor vetoes it.
We talked about medical aid in dying in New Jersey, one of 10 states that currently has a law allowing it. Delaware could be the 11th, but like you said, Governor Carney has not said whether or not he would sign the bill. He could also just let it pass into law without a signature, which is a possibility, or he could veto. And clearly 11-10 is not a veto-proof majority. So we shall see if Delaware indeed becomes the 11th state to allow medical aid in dying. Interesting story today in the Inquirer, Cherry. Did you know? This blew my mind. Philly issued 500,000 traffic citations in 1998. Last year, 45,000, a 91% drop in traffic citations in the city of Philadelphia, according to the Inky analysis. But now the police say they want to bring back traffic citations as a bigger tool in clamping down on reckless driving. So there's been this huge crash over 25 years, but there have been more crashes on the roadways, and they think this is a way to combat it.
Yeah, I mean, and the numbers were stark. I mean, 577 people died in traffic-related incidents between 2020 and 2023. That's literally 188 more deaths than the previous 4 years. So the number of people dying because of traffic stuff.
And a lot of the people dying are pedestrians.
Pedestrians.
And bicyclists.
So, I mean, the numbers sound, I know a lot of people hate numbers, but I mean, people are dying. The roads are more dangerous. And the question is whether writing more traffic citations will be the answer to this.
But that means more interactions between police and motorists, and we know that can go awry. It also means more police resources dedicated to this and not to perhaps stopping
violent crime.
Violent crime. So there's a lot of trade-offs here. You could also go the route, we talked about this the other week, of automatic speed enforcement, traffic cameras.
But or those, traffic calming measures. Big old
all
speed
that
bumps
stuff,
and things. Yeah.
Takes time and money, though.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that conceivably you could start to do now. And they are starting to do it now. They say they're starting to issue more and more of these traffic citations in Philadelphia. Something to watch.
Yeah, definitely something to watch. Another thing we're going to be watching is this test. The Philadelphia School District, they're piloting a year-round school program in 20 facilities. This was a campaign promise by Mayor Parker.
Year-round school.
Yes, year-round school. They'll offer free before and after care by so-called out-of-school time providers. A lot of these folks already have contracts with the district to provide other services. And like I said, Mayor Parker sort of promised this when she was on the campaign trail. She's a mom, mm-hmm. and a lot of parents have issues with before and after care, and it keeps them from being able to go to work. And of course, she called everybody back to work. So this would fill in the gap for some of that child care for kids of a certain age. It'll start with the 2024-25 school year at 20 schools, including next summer. And of course, they're going to look at the outcomes of this and to see whether or not this is something that should be adopted district wide. Yeah, but there's a lot of hurdles. Yeah.
A ton of hurdles.
Yeah.
I'll talk about two big ones here. Mm-hmm. First, to do this more permanently, not with these contracted providers, but to do it permanently, you need the teachers union to be on board.
Yeah,
so you
got
to negotiate that.
Their
contract is up in 2025, so maybe there's some wiggle room there. Other huge hurdle. Many schools in Philadelphia do not have central air. If you want to have school in the summer, you need to keep the schools cool enough so that the kids can learn. And by the way, heat can be dangerous in the summer, especially in these old school buildings. Mm-hmm. So those are two huge hurdles. I don't know how they're going to surmount them. This is just a 20-school pilot program, and I guess we'll see.
Yeah, and 20 years ago, they did try it.
There was a pilot program at a single school in North Philadelphia. And they did it for a few years. And what they did there was they sort of spaced the school year out. So there were still breaks, but there wasn't one big summer break. And the idea was to cut back on summer learning loss. A lot of kids will lose knowledge over a big summer break.
The summer slide.
You might have heard about that. But they only did it for 4 years at one school. So this would be a much bigger effort if indeed it moves forward.
So we'll be watching.
Turning our attention now to a big star with a decades-long residency in beloved South Philadelphia, right across from the IKEA. And I'm talking about the SS United States. She is the fastest ocean liner to cross the Atlantic. After the financial collapse of its original owner, the United States Line, parts of the ship were sold off at auctions, leaving her stripped in a pier in Philadelphia.
And you've probably seen it. Since 2011, the SS US Conservancy, they've owned the vessel. The group faces new challenges since a judge ruled that the pier owner can evict the ship from its berth. The president of the SS United States Conservancy is Susan Gibbs. She is also the granddaughter of William Francis Gibbs, the Philadelphia-born naval architect who designed the ship. Susan, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Susan, can you tell folks what makes this ship so special and why you think it's worth saving?
Well, she debuted in 1952 as the fastest ocean liner ever built. But in addition to that, she remains this enduring and inspiring national symbol that I think still can bring us together as a nation. She's a remarkable historic accomplishment, and Philly has been very lucky to have her all these years.
Now, you know, Susan, I've seen the ship, I think, driving up and down Columbus Boulevard. It's been sitting there for quite some time, for decades, since the 90s. But I understand that there have been some future plans for this ship. What is the vision for it?
Yeah, the vision is that she can be revitalized. Admittedly, she is a little worse for the wear, and the paint is fading and peeling, but she is still structurally sound because she was so overbuilt to begin with. She was a convertible troop ship, and so she is still able to be refurbished. And so we have been pursuing plans for her to become a mixed-use museum, hotel, event space, an extraordinary commercially funded project that we have made a great deal of progress in advancing. But what we still are missing is a permanent pier location for the project.
Well, what kind of progress have you made so far? Because from the outside, I think people see something that's kind of in stasis. I mean, what types of progress are you talking about there?
Yeah, there have been extraordinary plans developed. I encourage anyone interested in learning more to go to our website or just Google SS United States Conservancy, and we have some amazing renderings that are available to view showing what she could look like. So there have been great plans advanced, And what we need now, we need a new location. Needless to say, we are that, and time is dwindling.
And so let's talk about this dispute, because the ship has been sitting at Pier 82 and had been having no issues, and then all of a sudden this court case came up. What happened, and what do you need to resolve it?
Yeah, basically what happened is that our landlord at the pier doubled our rent with virtually no notice and issued an eviction order. And we ended up going to court, and the judge in the case, U.S. District Court Senior Judge Anita Brody, ruled back on, well, not that far ago, on June 14th, that on the plus side for us, our peer landlord was not entitled to all of the back rent that they that they alleged we owed. On the other hand, we were issued, or the ruling evicted the ship, and we need to find a new location by September 12th. So we are taking this time to, I don't usually use sports metaphors, but an all hands on deck moment, mm-hmm. and are searching, you know, high and low for at least an interim location, and have announced a fundraising initiative. And, you know, we recognize that her, you know, we need to find her a new home and keep her safe. And it would be just a tragedy if she couldn't be saved.
Yeah. So how much money do you need by this September date? And I know you say you're searching high and low. Can you give us some idea of some potential interim docking places for a ship this big?
Yeah,
and if folks haven't seen it,
yeah.
I mean, it is truly massive.
Yeah, well, it is massive. It's almost 1,000 feet long. It's 100 feet longer than the Titanic. We like to say that the SS United States is the most famous ship that didn't sink. Mm. And so she is, yeah, there aren't a lot of piers that can accommodate a vessel of her size, but there are certainly some, and you can imagine where they are. They're in the big, great port cities and so, including Philadelphia. So Philadelphia, Newport News, Hampton Roads area, New York, you know, we're looking in a number of different locations, and we're making progress.
And so you've launched this. How much are you trying to raise? And what happens if you don't meet the target?
Yeah, well, we announced a $500,000 fundraising campaign to cover the costs of the ship's potential relocation. Obviously, it is contingent on identifying and securing an alternate location. I should also mention that the conservancy is, you know, has ongoing costs associated with just keeping the lights on, so to speak, and paying the rent and taking good care of the ship. And we also have, earlier on, you mentioned that decades ago, there was an auction of all of the ship's interior furnishings by a previous owner. And so we have, for the past decade, been assembling an amazing collection of artifacts and art and memorabilia and all sorts of, you know, an amazing museum collection of artifacts from the vessel. And so we are also stewarding that collection.
About a minute left, Susan Gibbs, but can you tell us, is there a preferred plan B if you cannot save the ship?
I would say, I won't say preferred, but certainly, you know, given the emergency that we're facing, we are exploring all options. And so, of course, the two other options there are converting the ship into an artificial underwater reef and recycling the vessel. There are firms in the U.S. that are capable of conducting that work. Needless to say, they are. I don't want to call them Plan Bs. I would like to call them Plan some letter way down
plan
in the
Z,
bottom
yeah.
of the alphabet.
But is one of those preferable, turning it into a reef or doing the recycling option? We have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I can't answer that question at
okay.
this point. I think they both have their pros and cons, but we're focusing all of our energy on trying to keep the ship proudly afloat and remaining as an enduring historic, you know, expression of American technological innovation and resilience.
Well, that was the voice of Susan Gibbs. with the SS United States Conservancy. She's the president of that organization. As you just heard, they are trying to save this ship, which is being evicted from its pier in September. So the clock is ticking. Susan Gibbs, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you so much.
And coming up, lots of Supreme Court decisions rolling out. Share your questions and reactions now by emailing studio2@whyy.org. You can also call us at 888-477-9499. We'll be right back. Lots to come.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The Supreme Court is nearing the end of its session. The summer recess is fast approaching, but there are still a lot of consequential decisions that have not been released, including the cases about presidential immunity, the January 6th rioters, and abortion. Two decisions did come out this morning, including one of the social media cases. It's about the government's right to pressure companies to remove posts they find problematic.
The court sided 6-3 with the Biden administration in that case about content moderation, saying the challengers didn't have legal standing. Now, with just days left in this term, we're going to discuss the decisions that have come out and the ones that remain. And we're going to look at some of the controversies that have dogged this court, and there are many. David Cohen is with us in studio. He's a professor at Drexel University's Klein School of Law. David, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me again.
So, David, we wanted to start with that ruling that just came out. It's 6-3. It broke the ranks of political ideology. I want you to tell us about this case and its significance.
Yeah, so the court has issued seen several cases in the past few years about social media, and this is one of them where some conservative states challenged the Biden administration, saying that you cannot talk to social media companies to try to persuade them to take down false information, particularly around the COVID vaccine. So what the Biden administration was doing was encouraging Facebook and Twitter to flag or even take down information that was not factual about the vaccine. And these conservative state attorney generals said that the government cannot pressure private entities to do that. That's a violation of the First Amendment.
And the court here, 6-3, held that the plaintiffs in the case did not have standing. They never really dealt with the First Amendment issue. Did they punt?
Yeah, so the court does this from time to time, where they have these highly controversial cases that are brought by someone who's not really connected with the case, right? You can't just go into court and say, I don't like something.
Right.
It has to actually harm you in some way. And so what the court said in this case, 6-3, is that the attorney generals and the five individuals who brought this case are not individually harmed by the government's talking to Facebook and Twitter about this, that they didn't. And even so, they don't show that they're going to be harmed in the future mm-hmm. by anything like this. And so the court did not say anything about the appropriateness under the Constitution of the government trying to pressure these private companies to take down non-factual information. The court said nothing about that. All it said was that these individuals challenging this action cannot do that.
If you want to join this conversation on the ongoing Supreme Court session, you can give us a call, 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-WHYY. You can also email us, studio2@whyy.org. In that vein, the case around mifepristone, which is what a lot of people will call the abortion pill, seemed to come down in a similar way, right, David, where they didn't really rule on the legality of the pill itself, but more they said that the plaintiffs were the wrong plaintiffs. Do I have that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was decided a week or two ago, and it was a very similar situation. You have a very conservative anti-abortion organization, not the government this time, but an organization saying, we don't like the abortion pill, mifepristone, which was approved by the FDA in 2000 as safe and effective. And so they challenged this in court, saying that we have some doctors that are a part of our organization who may sometime in the future treat someone who has a complication related to this pill. Mm. And so these doctors are harmed by having to treat someone who's done something that they don't like. And the lower court said, yes, that is enough personal injury to have standing to challenge this case. But the Supreme Court, in a unanimous opinion last week, said that's not appropriate. You do not have standing because doctors treat people all the time that they don't agree with their actions. And there's no way to know that these doctors are going to see any particular patient and that that's going to harm them, what they do anyway.
So then what happens next with something like mifepristone? Is there going to be a new challenge and how might it be reconstituted?
That's yet to be seen. There are some states who are trying to challenge that, and maybe the states are going to have a harder time given today's decision in the social media case because the states were thrown out as as plaintiffs in that case. But there may be a new challenge to mifepristone by better plaintiffs, but we don't know. That's true in any case where they kick them out for lack of standing. We'll see what happens in the future, but there's no discussion of the merits in either of these cases. And I just want to flag one thing about these cases and a few cases last year that challenged Biden's immigration policy and the Indian Child Welfare Act and some aspects of Obamacare. The court threw all of those out on standing, too. And I think what we're seeing is that given how conservative this court is, we're seeing emboldened conservative organizations and states and attorney generals who are shooting for the stars. They're trying to attack policies that they don't like in court. And they're doing so in a way that at least this court is saying, well, you're going too far because you yourself are not injured.
Can I ask you something, though? Like, why not just find someone who's harmed? Like, for, I'm trying to think of this from the it's hard to find those people.
It's really hard.
Because I remember, like, the gay marriage case, they found someone who, you know, tried to get a marriage license, right, and was told no. I mean, that's my recollection of the case. Why not just find someone who would check some of those boxes?
So I think there's ongoing efforts to do that in some of these cases, but sometimes it's really hard, right? Think an individual to bring a case, it takes time, it takes their resources.
They have to dedicate their time.
Yeah, right. Yeah. This is a multi-year process. So to go through this as an individual, as opposed to
If you want results now, you just get a an organization, an activist organization.
Yeah,
just brings
or
the case.
Just you know, if you want results from a motivated attorney general who is looking for political points to score and already has a legal apparatus behind them, then file on your own behalf. If you want to wait and find someone who's actually injured, maybe that person's never going to show up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's uncertain.
Yeah, and these cases cost millions of dollars sometimes.
And they take a long time.
And I got to ask you, because those two cases that we just talked about, were they destroyed? They were across party lines or ideological lines. Another case that surprised folks was the 8-1 decision on the Second Amendment issue of whether or not, you know, people who have a restraining order for domestic violence have a right to have firearms. Can you talk about that issue and this sort of breaking from political ideology that we've seen the court do in a number of instances this session?
Yeah, so this case was it's called the Rahimi case, and it's not necessarily a surprise outcome because the facts were just so terrible for
they
Second
waited
Amendment
for the,
rights,
right?
Right. But what this draws on, the court has had a series of opinions in the past decade or so that has strengthened the Second Amendment. And a case that was decided the day before the abortion case 2 years ago. So Dobbs was decided on June 24th. The day before, it issued an incredibly consequential Second Amendment case called Bruin. And what the court did in that case was said, the only way you can restrict guns is if you can look back in time at the founding and find a historical analog to the restriction now. So if the founders restricted guns in this particular way, then you can restrict guns in this way now.
Wait, so were the founders restricting guns based on domestic violence restraining orders?
No, so that's why this case made its way through the lower court. So that was the decision from 2 years ago. Now you have Rahimi come along, and he's convicted of state domestic violence. He's a bad, bad guy. Everyone agrees with that. Dangerous. There's a federal law that says if you've been convicted of domestic violence, you cannot own guns.
Right.
And he's owned a gun, so he violated that. The Fifth Circuit, which is the Texas Court of Appeals, the federal court of appeals, said, well, the founders didn't care about domestic violence because they didn't care about it. So we don't have any similar law back from the early times. So this law is unconstitutional. And so that was taken by the Supreme Court. And so what happened last week was very interesting because Justice Thomas was the lone dissenter. And he said, the case I wrote 2 years ago means exactly what it says it means. if you can't find this historical analog, it's unconstitutional now.
He originalism, said, right?
Right, originalism. Yeah. He said, we can't find anything about domestic violence in the past, so this law is unconstitutional now. The other eight justices said, oh, wait, that's too much.
Yeah.
We need to pull back just a little on that Bruin case, that case from 2 years ago, because this guy's dangerous. And we can find laws that restrict gun ownership for people who are dangerous. So what they did is they made it a little more general. You have to find a historic similarity.
Yeah.
Right.
Interesting.
And let me quick follow up for that. Will it, because we've seen all these challenges to gun control laws across the country, probably more cases will be before the U.S. Supreme Court. And will this make it easier for some of these gun laws or these gun control laws to survive?
Big question following last week's decision, because there are countless challenges in the lower courts to gun possession laws related to felons. You know, if you're if you're a felon in certain sensitive public places like subways or schools or other places. And so the framers didn't regulate those things. So the argument is you can't do that now. And so after last week's decision, we will have to wait and see whether that will be taken more broadly and say you actually can regulate a lot more things than we thought 2 years ago, or if that was a one-off because Rahimi was such a bad guy.
If you want to get in on this conversation, we are talking about the Supreme Court of the United States, the decisions they've handed down, the ones that they've yet to hand down. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-WHYY. Our email address is studio2@whyy.org. And our guest is Drexel's David Cohen. There was another gun case that the court ruled on this session, but it wasn't a Second Amendment case. It had to do with these things called bump stocks. I'm almost not even used to the concept of an idea of a gun case that isn't Second Amendment related. How can it not be Second Amendment related?
Well, Second Amendment certainly in the background in how they're thinking about it, but this was a statutory interpretation case. This was about a law that was passed by Congress that prohibited a certain type of gun, a bump stock, and whether that covered certain types of weapons. And the Supreme Court interpreted the statute in a very narrow way, saying it did not cover certain guns that don't shoot automatically, and that is not prohibited under this statute. And so it basically was a win for the gun rights lobby because they basically were told that this particular type of gun, and I don't know the specifics of how this gun is manufactured, but this particular type of gun that is in wide distribution is not prohibited by federal law.
So if they change the federal law to explicitly ban that type of, and I think it's more something that converts a weapon to a different type of weapon, then it could be legal, but then I guess you would have to make a Second Amendment claim if you were
so
to try
first,
it again.
You always have to ask first, does the statute apply here? And then if it does apply here, is that statute
constitutional? Got it.
Yeah. So last week's, the bump stock case was on that first question.
And so that was along party lines or political, you know, ideological lines. Got to mention, because we have a couple cases related to former President Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And one was Trump's eligibility to be on the ballots in states. And that was a unanimous decision where the court held that states could not bar former President Trump from running for another term. And this was a pretty big deal because it was the first time the court had ever dealt with Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Pretty big deal.
Yeah. And so to be clear, this was only about the primary ballot in Colorado, not the general election ballot. But the similar principles would apply. And the Supreme Court said it's not up to the states to determine eligibility under that section of the Constitution. It's for Congress. And so they really sort of said, you know, states keep people off the ballot all the time for all sorts of reasons, right? If they don't meet the minimum petition, you know, we've all signed petitions for people to be on the ballot. That's a state requirement. And states keep people off for not meeting that requirement all the time. But states are not allowed to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. It was an odd decision because the language doesn't say that in the Constitution, that it's only for Congress, but the court interpreted it to say it's only for Congress.
And so, I mean, there were some other cases as well dealing with racial gerrymandering, also the First Amendment with the NRA v. Vullo case. But I want to talk about what's sort of ahead. The big case, the big...
Another Trump case.
Yeah, the other Trump case,
Trump,
right?
Trump versus the U.S., yeah.
Yeah, related to, you know, his immunity. Can you talk about this case? It's so critical, and we're waiting. Everybody's waiting.
We are waiting, and I think we won't get this before the debate tomorrow night. That's just my hunch. I don't have any inside information, but they are going to release opinions tomorrow and Friday, and I just don't think they'll release this Trump case the morning of the debate.
And so what's the big question
here? The big question is whether the federal government can prosecute a president for actions, an ex-president, for actions taken while they were president. And so the court has never addressed this issue before. It's a big deal to answer this question. Mm-hmm. The court has said that official acts taken while you're president cannot be the basis of a civil lawsuit. That was a Nixon case. But this is about questionably official or not acts. This is all about what he did around January 6th and about prosecuting him. And Trump is saying that I have immunity, that while I was president, nothing I did can be the subject of a criminal prosecution, because that would impinge on my Article 2, which is the presidential powers, my powers as president. If I had to worry, once I get out of office, will the next president prosecute me? So these things are just off limits.
Yeah.
And Jack Smith, the prosecutor here, is arguing to the Supreme Court, one, that you can't just have a flat everything's off limits during president.
Yeah,
that would allow them to,
immunity, yeah.
That would just allow them to do all sorts of evil things. But two, if you do have some kind of immunity for while they're president, it should only be for official acts. And what he did around January 6th was not official.
Yeah, and we have a couple more cases, and we want to get through these quickly. January 6th rioters, whether or not prosecution can happen there. Emergency abortion care. Can you quickly just talk about those? We're waiting.
Yeah, we're waiting for it. So the January 6th case is about whether there's a federal statute that prohibits obstructing official activity and whether official happenings, and whether that can be the basis of some of the January 6th charges. I think about a third or a quarter of the January 6th defendants have been charged with this. But interestingly, so has Donald Trump. In the D.C. case, two of his charges have to do with obstructing official proceedings. That was the word I was looking for. Obstruction of official proceedings. And so what the court says here about the January 6th defendants could impact as well the January 6th prosecution in federal court in D.C. of Trump. So that could also impact Trump. And then the abortion case, this has to do with a federal law which requires emergency rooms to provide stabilizing care for anyone who comes to them, any emergency room. And so the question is, what about in the states that ban abortion, like Idaho, which is in this case, where there's only an exception if your life is at risk, if you are going to die, that otherwise you can't get an abortion? Well, what happens if someone comes into an emergency room in Idaho and their life isn't at risk because of pregnancy complications, but their health is? Mm. And the emergency room doctor says, to stabilize this patient, I need to do an abortion. But Idaho law doesn't let me do an abortion because the life is not at risk. Do I have to wait for this person to get so sick that she's about to die before I can perform this abortion? Mm-hmm. Idaho said, yes, you have to wait. And the United States has said, no. The federal law means you have to do, you
have to
can
stabilize.
Do the abortion, stabilize. Yeah. And so the Supreme Court's going to be deciding that in the next day or two as well.
Email here from Tommy, who says, I think Amy Coney Barrett is not as MAGA as Trump thought she would be. The complexion of the court right now, politically, ideologically, is it what we expected this term, or has it surprised?
Yeah, I think it is a very conservative court, maybe the most conservative court ever. And certainly we will see over the next 2 days just how conservative. But there are gradations of conservativeness among the six Republican-appointed justices. And I think the email is correct. Justice Barrett is not as conservative, say, as Justices Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch. They are certainly the three most conservative justices on the court. And Barrett, Kavanaugh, and Roberts are conservative. They are very conservative by historic standards. They just are not as conservative as their three other colleagues.
So when you see those six threes, you tend either the threes are the three liberals, or the threes are the three extreme conservatives typically.
Correct. Yeah. Justice Thomas, Gorsuch, and Alito dissent a lot together.
Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. And so I want to touch on one more case because I think it could have impact here in Philadelphia. It's the restrictions on homelessness. We're waiting on that. It's an Eighth Amendment case. We had did a whole segment about it. If you gave us a 30-second version of that case, yeah.
Yeah, so this is out of Oregon, and the local law prohibits sleeping in public with a pillow or a blanket or a tent. And so the challengers say that this basically criminalizes the state of being homelessness and a basic need. You need to sleep.
Yeah.
And so is that cruel and unusual punishment to do so? That's what the court is considering.
Yeah, we
got to talk
ethics.
Email from Margaret. The court refuses to adopt a reasonable code of ethics, and certain members clearly flaunt ethical impartiality. We had the whole situation with Alito's house and the January 6th
flags.
We've got more stuff with Justice Thomas and this billionaire benefactor, Harlan Crow. What can you tell us in about a minute on, you know, where the court stands in the public eye and whether it needs to revisit these ethics issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the court has taken baby steps around ethics, but it really just is basically saying you can't control us. There's not going to be a law passed in Congress. They know that because of gridlock. And so they're doing whatever they want. There was a decision today in a case called Snyder
case, yeah,
that had to do with giving gifts to public officials after they've done something you like. So not a bribe beforehand, but a gratuity afterwards. And the Supreme Court, 6-3 along ideological lines, said that does not violate federal bribery law. And Justice Jackson wrote a dissent where she really called out her colleagues. She said, officials who use their public positions for private gain threaten the integrity of our most important institutions. That's the sentence that starts her dissent.
Wow.
And it's basically, it's got to be directed right at her colleagues sitting across the bench.
Wow. Justice Thomas, you mean?
Yeah, Justice Thomas.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Justice Alito, some allegations around Gorsuch and trips to Europe.
Interesting.
And a lot to go next season, next session, LGBT rights, other issues. We're going to be watching the court for sure.
And we're going to be watching with you, David Cohen, law professor at the Klein School of Law. Thanks for joining us again on Studio 2.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we hear from an artist featured at the Philadelphia Museum of Art whose journey began in the prison system. Studio 2 will be right back. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The United States incarcerates more people than any other country in the world, with over 1.8 million people currently locked up. It can be life-altering and traumatic, but one Philadelphia-based artist used his time behind bars as inspiration for something truly unique, a massive work of art.
The artist is Jesse Crimes, and the artwork is Riker's Quilt. It's a 20 by 30 foot layered quilt featuring over 3,000 images of people abused while at Riker's Island. That's one of New York's most notorious prisons. Crimes created the piece using prison bed sheets, and it's now on display at the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
Crimes says his work is meant to humanize the people most impacted by mass incarceration, and it's based on personal experience. He grew up in Lancaster and spent much of his teen years stuck in a revolving door of state institutions. He managed to go to college, but by his early 20s, he was indicted on drug charges and sentenced to 6 years in federal prison. Cherry sat down with Crimes to talk about how art helped him transform behind the wall.
Talk about what it was like being in jail, awaiting sentencing, and having to figure out how are you going to do 6 years.
There was definitely a very, I think, significant moment for me. You know, since the age of 13, I've pretty much transitioned through nearly every facet of the criminal justice system. And so I was on juvenile probation and then jail, and then I went to state prison, and I eventually ended up going to federal prison. But the last time that I was in federal prison, it was really, it was a moment of clarity for me. One, because the system functions very different from all of the other systems I had mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Where I was arrested with 140 grams of cocaine, but when I refused to cooperate and basically tell on other people, they increased my drug weights up to 50 kilos. And that effectively increased my sentencing guideline range from around 30 months to a mandatory minimum of 10 years to life. And so I'm sitting in solitary confinement, awaiting sentencing, presumably still innocent at this point. And
how old are you at this point?
I believe I was 24.
So you're 24 years old. This is some significant time that you are facing.
Yeah, and I had just graduated from college. So I had just got my degree in art from Millersville University. And, you know, future was looking bright. I had all of my applications in to go to grad school at all of the top art schools across the country. And then I got indicted. And so it was this pretty abrupt shift in my life. And when I realized that they could pretty much just like fabricate drug weights, that they could pretty much give me any amount of time that they wanted to. Like, I really had no say in the matter, and it wasn't tied to anything in reality of what I was actually culpable for. And I think that realization and the fact that they could move me from the jail that I was in to a completely different jail, put me in solitary confinement, they took everything I've had on the outside, removed me from the community and my family. And it was in that moment when I realized that the only thing that they couldn't take from me was my ability to create. And that was the moment when I was able to really replace this identity of thinking of myself throughout my life as somehow different or like a criminal and think of myself as an artist. And that shift just internally really fortified me as I went through the rest of the system. And I just made a decision that, you know, if I get 10 years or if I get 20 years, or if I get life, like, I'm going to use every minute of this time to do something productive with myself around art. And I had just found out I was having a son.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he was born when I was in prison. And artwork, again, was like a way, it was a way for me to create something tangible to send to him, to show him that I love him, to show him that I care. And it was also something that other people inside would commission me to do for them and their loved ones for anniversaries or birthdays. And so it became this really powerful kind of organizing tool of connection and community, and really formed some serious strong bonds in a place that is often very difficult to allow yourself to be vulnerable.
Yeah. And so you're in prison and you make, you know, this decision, I'm going to use every second I have to do art. What did your typical day look like?
I'd wake up around 5 a.m. They'd crack the doors around 5:30. I'd go out to the prison yard. I would run 5 miles. And then after that, they would allow me and my one friend to actually work in the recreation department before everyone else was let out. And so it was the only time we'd have, like, peace and quiet. It's such a precious thing when you're inside because there's no respite from just, like, constant noise. And so we would make art, and it was just incredibly helpful to help me process this trauma and all of these things that had occurred to me throughout my life, but also in the exact kind of environment that I was being housed in as well. And like really understanding that, you know, up to that point, my failings were not my own kind of personal failings alone, right? They were in combination with this kind of much larger, more complex, more nuanced kind of systemic way that we have designed systems to actually oppress and harm people.
Because you didn't know your real dad, right? Your biological father, your stepdad took his own life. You know, just had a lot of stuff happen in life growing up that there is no space for you to process it. And then the penal system sort of steps in and is the fail-safe for so many people who don't have that type of support.
Yeah, I mean, the carceral system is really kind of the catch-all for all sorts of unprocessed trauma. I really truly believe that it's the only system. It's the single largest expenditure between police and prisons of any city budget or county budget in the name of safety and justice. And it's incredibly flawed in my mind because so many of the people who are in there are clearly traumatized. And there's no outlets, there's no real ways for people to process things. And I just think, like, had I been given the opportunity when I was actually out in society before all of these things transpired through the carceral system, through this like punitive approach, I feel like I could have processed these things. I feel like I could have talked to someone. I could have unpacked why I felt lonely or responsible or guilty or shameful or all of these things that I felt around the suicide of my father, around the abandonment of my biological father. And like I was just looking for ways to form an identity with no real kind of like reflective thing to look at to form that identity. And so I was just kind of left to my own devices for most of my life. And I feel like if I would have just, again, had any inkling of kind of opportunity to actually unpack and explore some of those things, that I would have never have ended up in the carceral system in the first place.
I want to talk about the opportunity that you represent, because you're a white guy. People on the radio can't see that. But, you know, prison and incarceration and the criminal justice system disproportionately impacts Black and brown people. But you, being who you are, you get in rooms, you get in spaces, you can have conversations and convince people that if you were a person of color, you might not be able to convince those folks. Can you talk about the unique opportunity presented to you?
I don't know. I feel a sense of personal responsibility having gone through that system, but also with the recognition that, you know, all of these systems that we're talking about have been constructed by white people for hundreds of years. And so the responsibility and the kind of onerous to undo these systems of harm and oppression really feels like it falls on our shoulders. It's not something that we should be asking Black and brown people to be reforming, to be on the front lines, to be advocating for. While they often are, it is not the thing that we should, as a society, should be asking people to do.
And if you were to look back at your younger self, what would you say to that version of Jesse Crimes?
That's a great question. As long as that experience was in the process of kind of finding myself and kind of processing that trauma, I wouldn't take any of it back, because I think it led me to a place of real understanding in a way that I might not have come to. And I'm not saying that the prison system fostered that. I'm saying that this came about in spite of the prison system. And so the prison system had done everything it could to get me to buy into the idea that I did not have any value, that I was worthless. And I think my grounding in this identity as an artist was in direct opposition to that force trying to tear me apart. And I think that I just have such a clear sense of who I am, of what my purpose is in this world, and I wouldn't change anything that's happened.
That's so beautiful. I've always asked, whenever something bad or something that I don't like happens, I always ask myself, how can we turn this into something that all these good things would have never happened had it not been for that thing? So you've done that.
I have. And I think the other thing that's really important to understand is that everyone who ends up in the carceral system has asked themselves that same question. No one goes into the carceral system and asks themselves that question and then decides, I want to be worse than when I came in.
Yeah.
No one makes that decision. So every single person who goes into the carceral system grapples with why they got there and what they need to do to never go back there. And then over time, because we provide nothing for people on the outside, we provide nothing for people on the inside, people get ground down into hopelessness. And so I know that the system that we have is currently not working. And I know that we have the absolute potential to create systems of actual liberation and reparations and things that will be productive and help everyone who's incarcerated and, by proxy, the rest of society.
Wow. That's a great vision. Great vision, Jesse. Yeah. Well, with that, thank you so much. Jesse Crimes, by the way, cool name.
Thank you. Yeah, I was born with that.
It is a cool name.
It is.
And a cool interview. Riker's Quilt by Jesse Crimes is on display at the Philadelphia Museum of Art through July 15th. It'll head to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City this fall.
Yes, and that ends today's episode of Studio 2. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez engineered today's show. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.